Welcome back to Explore Cell Therapy, where hematology, oncology, and transplant experts examine practice-changing research and hot topics in hematopoietic stem cell transplantation and other cellular therapies. I'm your host, Sam Waters, Research and Education Lead at the National Marrow Donor Program, NMDP Be the Match. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Zach DePhillip and Dr. Andrew Bruner of Massachusetts General Hospital, both members of the American Society for Transplantation and Cellular Therapy, or ASTCT, Committee on Practice Guidelines. Together, we examine the new guidelines published for transplant in the management and treatment of MDS. We discuss their findings on the most current indications for transplant, addressing changes in risk stratification and the success of transplant in older patients. To read bios on the session moderator and panelists, and to access additional resources related to this panel discussion, click the link in the episode description. This is part two of a two-part episode. So it sounds like, you know, considering some of the recommendations that you make in this publication, things like, you know, not having a set age limit, you know, as we've been discussing when considering transplant. It sounds like there is some of these are slow to make their way into practice necessarily. Are there other or any common sort of misperceptions or biases based on the way things used to be done that you think are important to call attention to among a transplant and hematology oncology physician audience that you think contribute to access for transplant and MDS?
Well, it's a good question. I think we are doing better. More patients that I see on referral will have had sequencing, molecular sequencing, and so I think that that is increasingly used in assessing at least the molecular profile. Now, using that in risk assessment is still evolving. Another big area where that is growing but is not fully established, we are increasingly recognizing familial risk for MDS. Now, this is still the minority of patients. Most patients will, their main risk factor is aging. Living long enough under the sun that mutated cells in the bone marrow can expand and rise to MDS. But a sizable minority of patients, 10 to maybe even 20% of patients, may have some predisposing factor that led to this. And I think that understanding how that both plays a role in counseling a patient about their disease and maybe risk in their family, but also understanding how that impacts outcomes and what kind of transplant conditioning or other therapy may be relevant to use. I think that is helping us refine care quite a bit. That is something still probably in evolution, but increasingly something that we pay attention to in care. I mean, in general, it's tough to shift how you treat patients overall. If you take care of somebody and something one strategy works, you know, it's hard to make big shifts in care patterns. But I do think that we're getting a overall better understanding of the expected course for patients and trying to be realistic with them about goals.
Yeah. One thing I would add to what Andy's saying, and we alluded to it a little earlier about the issue of access. I think it's also about really continuing to strive to have good collaboration between transplant centers and non-transplant physicians, right? Other hematology oncology physicians, whether they're practicing in the community or at academic center, whatever it may be. You know, the overall goal here, it's not necessarily that every single patient should be transplanted, right? It's about keeping the door open for all potential useful therapies for these patients. And the reality is that transplant is logistically complicated. It just is on multiple fronts. You know, it's the logistics about hospital stays and medications and length of distance from maybe with to the transplant center, you know, and even if the transplant treatment itself is done within a hospitalization, it requires a long-term follow-up for, you know, to monitor medications and look for different long-term complications. I think it's a little easier to get patients to be seen by the transplant physician when the transplant physician and the referring physician have a personal connection, whether that is that they've collaborated on other patients. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they know each other in person and go out to dinner, right? You know, but even if you have that phone call, the cell phone number, the email of somebody that's within network that you feel that you have camaraderie with, you know, I rely on referring physicians all the time. I'm sure there are certain patients with complex, you know, factors that I don't necessarily appreciate about whether maybe that decision is being made for referral or not. And I trust those referring physicians because they know the patient and their situation way better than I do, sight unseen. But ultimately, I think that I have seen in recent years that once I get to know a referring physician and taking care of a patient or one or two patients, I think that we remove some of those initial barriers to referral, I start to see more patients maybe coming to be seen, and then we can try to figure out if transplant's the right option for them.
No, I think that's a great point you bring up, and there's a lot of discussion around sort of emerging models of shared or coordinated care between transplant centers and hematology oncology practitioners, or whether they be, you know, whether they're, like you said, a couple doors down and you can go have that conversation, or it's more of a phone call or trying to make sure that you have that established connection to community practices that don't necessarily have a pre-established organizational connection to a transplant center.
Just one other topic or point on that. I really view the referring physicians, especially those in the community, as key to these patients' care, because it's not only just about getting them initial access to the transplant, but yes, the transplant itself and the early transplant care really needs to be done with the transplant team at the transplant center. But especially for patients who are coming from a distance, you know, from hours away, you know, my preference is that they can get some of their care closer to home just to ease this process for them, just to make it easier for them. They don't necessarily need to drive all these hours to see me or my team for every routine thing. And I really enjoy when we're able to get to a point a little later on where I can re-engage patients with the referring community physician. So maybe they can go there and get labs done and be seen there sometimes instead of coming all the way back to Boston. If there are some infusions or other things that need to be done that patients would just prefer, like, hey, can I go 10 minutes down the road to the person that I know that's close to home? These are things that I think are immensely important. And there's a lot of long-term survivorship issues, you know, health screening things that need to be done, whether that's being done by the local oncologist or the primary care physician. You know, it's something that while the transplant team alone can give guidance, we're just not equipped to do all these things. And I think they actually get better, more well-rounded care when they have more people involved in their care, especially at the later time points.
I mean, the same could be said just in general about MDS care. You know, MDS is a burden. if you don't make blood, it you rely heavily on transfusion support, antibiotics, quick management of infectious issues or bleeding issues. You know, I am constantly trying to figure out logistical plans for patients even before transplant, right? My therapy is every month. You have a week of therapy. You have transfusions up to maybe twice a week. It's a part-time job. And if you're not nearby, it is a logistical challenge. And so collaborating early with, you know, colleagues that are perhaps closer to where someone lives is critical from day one of an MDS diagnosis. But I think that, you know, having that opportunity to go back and forth, you know, can really make an impact on a patient's course, their understanding of disease, their availability of clinical trials, which still play a huge role in MDS care, and that access to transplant discussions. And absolutely, not every patient, you know, this may not be the right course for them. But unless they have a chance to talk about it or understand what it would take or some of the logistics or understand some, you know, even what kind of donor options they have and what would it be like to go through transplant. I think if you never have that opportunity, it's a different case than having patients who are well informed and, you know, this is just not the path for me, or I want to do something else. I think that feels more, it's a different discussion than people who never have opportunity.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. And I would imagine that having that relationship, that established connection between you two, also really builds confidence for the patient in the treatment option as well. Just knowing that there's this united front between multiple specialists, I think, could be particularly valuable. One thing that I want to touch on a little bit that we haven't really discussed in terms of risk stratification and major considerations with transplant is the risk of relapse, which we know is always a major consideration with any treatment option. So what strategies do you currently use to sort of understand relapse risk? I know we've talked a little bit about key genetic markers and things like that, but you know, how are you sort of unwrapping that concept of relapse risk, and what methods do you use, if any, to try to prevent relapse after transplant?
It's a great question. It's a course in statistics. It is hard to have a blood cancer. It's an existential problem in some ways because you're talking about risks, you're talking about immediate risks, and you're talking about long-term risks and probabilities. And, you know, when I talk to patients, I'm talking about what's going to happen when we start a chemotherapy, what's the likelihood that you'll have a problem within the next few months, but then also down the line, what are we dealing with as far as probabilities for 3 year, 5 year, 10 year, 10 years from now? Are you going to be where will you be? And I think that those are concepts that are really difficult, especially to balance with our therapies, which are not perfect. They're not a walk in the park. They are generally outpatient, though. They have a different experience, a different patient experience for the first couple months. Transplant has a different patient experience up front, but then, you know, shifts dramatically from chemotherapy later on. And relapse plays a big role in that. Most of what we understand about preventing relapse, and most of what we talk about with patients, you know, deals with A, nobody wants to go through a big treatment, whatever it is, just to relapse eventually. Even chemotherapy, you know, people worry about if I've got a response, how long am I going to have it? But then B, what can we do to mitigate that? It's still an evolving question. Some of that is practical. So a transplant doesn't happen overnight. If we have people with high-risk features, even though the evidence is harder to sift through, we generally do try to get as good a response as possible of their disease prior to going to transplant. The way I interpret some of the recent data is you don't really want to delay people unnecessarily to get a response, but it's probably still worth having, especially for people who have a reduced intensity conditioning regimen, probably still worth having as good control as you can of their disease going into transplant. And maybe there's some evolving practice around certain very high-risk mutations, such as P53, but these are still not things that would prohibit me from proceeding with a treatment strategy if it's logistically ready to go. I think one of the areas that both Zach and I are really interested in is not just optimization a little bit before transplant, but how do you, in these very high-risk patients, how do you prevent relapse, and is there more than just monitoring that we should be doing therapeutically to try to prevent relapse? And some of that comes into this concept that's evolving of maintenance strategies, maintenance therapies after transplant to try to prevent relapse. Perhaps most substantially studied in BCR-ABL positive malignancies, so patients who have a BCR-ABL mutation, being on a BCR-ABL directed tyrosine kinase inhibitor pill that you can take daily, and trying to continue that after transplant to prevent relapse. But now that we're exploring in other mutation-directed therapies, FLT3 inhibitors in AML, IDH1 or IDH2 inhibitors are being explored in MDS and AML, and also mutation agnostic therapies. So, we use azacitidine and decitabine up front in the treatment of MDS. Can we use that after transplant at lower doses or tolerable doses to try to maintain the graft and avoid relapse, especially early in these high risk cases?
Yeah. Just to kind of build on that, transplant, there are a number of competing risks for a patient when they undergo transplant. And the truth is that, we've made significant advances in limiting infection, in limiting graft-versus-host disease, in limiting other toxicities early on after the transplant. But kind of the elephant in the room is that when you decrease those other toxicities or other risks, the thing that remains is the disease, the potential for disease relapse. And I think what's always important to remember with the transplant is, like, the way I try to describe it to patients is, like, the transplant doesn't have its full effect immediately. All right. The transplant, what are we introducing? What are we doing? We're exchanging the patient's bone marrow for these new cells that will form their new bone marrow. But this is not, this is like planting seeds. They have to develop, they have to evolve. And the biggest concern is that while we're trying to allow that transplant to eventually get to its full strength, that the disease can have a tendency to try to come back. And that's really where what Dr. Bruner was talking about here about the different maintenance strategies is, while the transplant is still coming into its full self, is there an opportunity to give an extra layer of treatment just to try to hold things at bay to let the transplant eventually kind of take its full effect? And I think, in MDS, it is unclear at this point, how effective these strategies can be. What's the best agent to use? Is there a specific patient population to be targeting with these approaches? These are a lot of questions that are out there, but I think my bigger picture take is that, more oral targeted agents are usually easier to administer, and I think will have the highest likelihood of being able to be potentially successful in that space. You know, obviously agents that are cumbersome in their administration or have a high toxicity profile are not ideal candidates in that setting.
Yeah, it's definitely a space that is still investigational. And we have a tough debate in the field for people, you know, if you have a very high risk mutation, what's the best strategy? Do you apply data from the whole cohort, right? Showing, you know, do you take a trial like one of the studies that we were discussing about allo transplant early in disease? Do we take data from that and say, well, this is the whole cohort, we should treat everybody this way? Or do we worry about specific subgroups that, you know, have always been known to be challenging? I think that that's a place where clinical trials are still important. In outside of a trial context, you know, I think that you have a frank conversation with patients about what risks we're up against and also what we can try to do about them. I agree completely with Zach. You know, post-transplant is a little bit of a different space. And so introducing some of the chemotherapies that we use for leukemia or MDS care historically is difficult. With a young graft, you don't want to throw that off. You don't want to alter its maturation. But with highly targeted therapies, that has really changed our perspective. And I think that's where the field is trying to get to as far as clinical trials. And that's another reason to be seen at a center that sees a lot of patients or that is a transplant center. It's just to have some exposure to these kind of trials and to especially many of them are developed with the patient in mind, understanding that we don't want you to have to travel far. We want to create a therapy that gets you back to normal life. The whole goal of this, right, the whole goal of any of our treatment is to fix this problem so that you can get on with your life and get away from being, you know, living the disease. And so I think that that's a particularly unique space that's evolving right now.
That's an excellent point. And thinking a little bit, sort of piggybacking off of that, I'd love to hear, we've sort of alluded to a lot of these throughout the discussion today, but, you know, sort of the top couple major sort of future advances or things that are coming up the road for treatment of MDS. I'd love to hear your thoughts and what you're particularly excited about in the field.
It depends on if you want to talk about it in the context of transplant or not. You know, one of the biggest problems I've discussed is that our response rates with azacitidine or decitabine alone are poor. And so it's not surprising if you've got something that gets a 15 to 20% remission rate, that when you look at a whole cohort of patients, whether or not they got azacitidine before or treatment with a transplant is murky waters. It's hard to interpret. Practically, is it what you do may not always align with what mostly retrospective studies have tried to evaluate. And it's hard to know how much of that is because we barely get anyone into a remission. We think that those patients who are responsive to treatment are the ones who do the best after transplant. Again, that's a retrospective assumption. But if we are able to get a therapy that improves the response rate in MDS and it causes a meaningful improvement in disease control, know, I would expect that that also would translate into better post-transplant outcomes, especially because we, with older patients, rely heavily on reduced intensity conditioning regimens for transplant. And so that's one area where we have now several phase 3 studies in MDS looking at both response rate and survival, looking at combination therapies added to azacitidine or decitabine, which if they can shift the response rate, will have a very meaningful impact. These include combining azacitidine with venetoclax upfront, which has already been approved in AML and has changed the treatment landscape there quite a bit. It also is looking at several novel agents that have immune mechanisms. So magrolimab, an anti-CD47 antibody, and sabatolimab, an anti-TIM3 antibody. Both of these may be also interesting because transplant is an immune therapy, and altering some of the immune-based approach to your disease up front or after transplant will probably give us more insight into understanding mechanisms of how the immune system plays a role in disease control. And then there's also a study using a retinoid, tamibarotene, with azacitidine. And so we have a number of phase 3 studies that in the next couple of years may read out and provide some better insight into optimization of disease pre-transplant and how we might improve survival in these patients with or without transplant. I think that the other excitement really in the disease comes from other compounds also in AML. And so, you know, some of the more interesting compounds being explored right now, menin inhibition is an interesting target. It seems like it targets NPM1 mutated disease as well as MLL rearranged disease in particular. Now, both of these are really AML mutations, but understanding whether there are even more patients that may benefit from that kind of intervention, I think will be increasingly relevant as well in MDS.
Anything to add, Dr. DePhillip?
In regards to specific agents, no, but the general thrust that I think that the two major areas for improvement in thinking about the application of transplant to MDS specifically really has to do about revised risk stratification and improved MDS specific therapies. And obviously Dr. Bruner kind of covered this just extensively, but you know, our combined opinion as of right now is that, you know, it's unclear with the current available therapies how important it is to of how much therapy patients really need before they go to transplant. But the caveat being that's with our current available therapies, right? Conceptually, what we've seen in other disease states such as AML and ALL is that in acute leukemia, it seems to be very important that if you can reduce their disease down as minimal as possible, that is often translate into better transplant, post-transplant outcomes, specifically when it comes to the issue of relapse. You know, given the nature of MDS and the therapies that are currently available, while they are able to, you know, potentially improve blood counts, potentially reduce the amount of disease to a certain degree, as Andy mentioned before, it's a very small proportion of patients who actually you would say are in a complete remission of their MDS with current available options. Now, if novel agents in combination with with these approaches, that maybe that changes things. Maybe we are able to achieve deeper remissions before transplant, and that would be very interesting to see how that translates out. If you apply as a proof of principle what we've seen in acute leukemia, maybe that really helps address this issue of relapse in a more efficient way. But I think the other piece is still understanding how we can use the emerging molecular data to identify subgroups of patients and their risk for transplant. I think one group that we really, you know, have a lot of difficulty with are patients who have P53 mutations and other high-risk features, either in their cytogenetics or others. You know, we kind of think about, like, do we want to approach the transplant a little differently? If we think, you know, do we want to try to give them a maintenance therapy post-transplant? You know, thinking about ways that we can optimize and individualize the approach or the application of transplant to specific subsets that are maybe not covered in the larger, broader clinical trials that help direct our care.
Well, this has been a really wonderful discussion. I'd just like to close out with, you know, any additional key takeaways or tips for best practice that you'd like to share as we end?
I think, you know, what has changed since the last time these guidelines were published? A lot of our nuance in management has been updated. I think the biggest thing that we now know is the value of that we've kind of replicated in a more substantial way is the value of transplant early in disease for people who have high-risk MDS features. There's still a lot of room to go in the future. Are there people where we can improve the outcomes even further, or certain high-risk mutation profiles that merit more active or novel therapeutic approaches? And conversely, are there patients where we can do a better job of minimizing toxicity? Patients who are highly likely to respond to transplant or therapy, where we can start dialing back some of what we do for them. These are open questions that, you know, I hope that molecular stratification can help us better understand in the future. But I think that this, you know, to me as a non-transplant physician, has just made it all the more important that I'm discussing that concept with my patients as I meet them, and that I'm getting them at least open to what transplant might look like for them early on in the diagnosis.
I think my main take home is that it's an exciting time for transplant. The transplant treatment itself has inherited challenges that, you know, have not necessarily vanished, but I think that we've been able to find ways to start to address them more significantly. And I think that what we've seen, and I have an appreciation for, is that over time, what we've been able to do to be able to provide safe and effective treatments for patients is really beyond probably what anybody would have ever imagined when the field of transplant began many decades ago. Despite that, you know, the number of the percentage of patients who actually even get in the door to have a conversation with a transplant expert and a transplant team is still relatively very small. And I think that that's just something that we have to continue to strive to do for our patients, is to be able to provide them access to care, provide them access to more advanced care, to transplant, which ultimately could be a potentially curative treatment for their disease.
Excellent, excellent points. Thank you both so much. And thank you both for joining me today. This has been really informative, and I hope it can help spread the word about this important review and draw some attention to these best practice recommendations in MDS. So thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Explore Cell Therapy. For more information and to access research and resources related to this episode, be sure to click the link in the episode description. Until next time on Explore Cell Therapy.